In our study this evening, we come again to the paragraph that consists of two verses, verses 11 and 12, where he is again summoning his readers to some kind of a conclusion. Am I saying then that they stumbled so as to fall? The question is whether Israel's transgression had caused them to fall. The word that's actually translated stumble is the root word for verse 12's translation of the word transgression. The issue of the verse 11, stumble, is a stumbling by violating some known precept or ignoring some insistence. And the question is whether their attitude and actions that were summarized at the end of chapter 10, that they're deliberately disbelieving and constantly argumentative, did that cause them, in the manifestation of it that culminated in the crucifixion of the Christ, did that cause God to decide that he was done with them? And if he did, then they have fallen. In other words, the fall is an eternal consequence. But his answer is no. And then he said, as we saw last time, that their transgression actually resulted in salvation coming to the Gentiles, because God's intention is to save Israel, and he's going to do it by making them jealous. In other words, there's all kinds of different kinds of motivations that can get people to turn to God. And apparently, this jealousy motivation is fairly strong, because he already said through Moses that he was going to make them jealous by people that were not a people. And by a nation that was not a nation, he was going to provoke them. So that, in effect, the point being there is verse 14, where Paul says, if somehow I might move to jealousy my fellow countrymen and save some of them. So the whole issue of provoking the jealousy, the crime that they committed was a heinous crime, but God has decided that he is simply going to address that crime by turning the blessing of salvation to the nations and demoting Israel, not out of the picture, but demoting them, because up until this time, Yahweh was the God of Israel. Salvation was of the Jews. And for the most part, the Gentile nations just went begging. They didn't have any real light, and they certainly didn't have prophets and whatnot effectively working among them. So God says, well, I'm going to fulfill my promise to Abraham, make of him a great nation, but if it takes a different approach, then I'll take that approach, and that approach is to make them jealous. So in our study this evening, we're going to come to verse 12. If their transgression be riches for the world and their failure be riches for the Gentiles, how much more will their fulfillment be? So in our last study, we considered the unexpected result of Israel's over-the-top transgression against God, particularly as it relates to Jesus of Nazareth. God has made the issue of what you believe about Jesus of Nazareth in respect to the claim that he is God's Lord and Christ. He has decided to make that a conditional fact that must be believed in order to be saved. He said that if you confess Jesus as Lord, and you'll be saved, if you believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead. So that was chapter 10. So the real issue here is the focus on Jesus of Nazareth and Israel's crucifixion of him. As God, the creator who created the people, he came into his own and his own received him not. And that's a real mild way of saying he came into his own and they murdered him. That's an over-the-top type of transgression. The first result concerned Israel. The question of result. What's going to happen here? Is God going to react to their transgression by putting them under condemnation so that their transgression has led them to failure? And the issue that Paul says in the verse is God did not react to that transgression as expected by consigning Israel to eternal perdition. That's what you would expect. That's the kind of thing that we gravitate to. When wicked people do wicked things, we don't mind at all when God just hammers them. And so the question is, well, is God going to hammer them in the final sense? And Paul's answer is unexpected, because he said no. And the second result in relation to verse 11 was that he was going to bring salvation to the Gentiles. He was going to make a way for the nations to participate in the promise of life. So as we move into verse 12, I think that it'd be helpful once again if I build off of that metaphor we used last time of the grain with the chaff and the winnowing fan in his hand, where he's separating the wheat from the chaff to gather the wheat in the barn, burn the chaff in the fire that does not stop. I think it'd be helpful for us to build off of that metaphor a little bit by looking at the way the word Israel is used by Paul and try to follow his reasoning, because it gets a little complicated. So I'd just like to remind you of five ways that the word Israel is used. The first time that Israel is actually used as Israel is in Genesis 32:28, where God changes Jacob's name. He said, you're not going to be Jacob anymore, you're going to be Israel. But there was a double kind of thrust to the name Israel, because the word means he that strives with God. And it fit the setting in a positive way, because he was wrestling with the angel of the Lord and he wouldn't turn him loose until he blessed him. So in a sense, Jacob was being very tenacious in expecting a blessing from God, and he wasn't going to turn loose until he got it. And so the angel of the Lord damaged his hip, but he gave him the blessing. So he that strives with God is a positive thing in the sense of a tenacity of confidence that if I just hang on here, God's going to bless me. But the other idea of he that strives with God is a characterization of Jacob as Jacob. That's called, because that's all he did all his lifetime, was fight with God over everything. Didn't matter what it was. No, this is a classic example of the argumentative disbelieving guy. So there's this double thing. But nonetheless, Israel as a name change came upon Jacob. So that Jacob is the negative factor, Israel is the positive. And that's the first time we have this reference to Israel. Then Israel became used quite often afterwards, because God had made a promise to Abraham back in Genesis 12 that he would make of him a great nation. And then we have the man, Jacob, whose name is Israel, being used by God through four different wives or women, two wives and two concubines, to produce the 12 tribes of Israel. And so they're the 12 tribes of Israel in the sense that they're the man Jacob's offspring, but they have now become tribal units under this concept of Israel. And it's a fulfillment of the promise that God's going to make of Abraham a great nation. So we have the word Israel used when the offspring of Jacob and Israel, or Jacob Israel, are considered a national entity, made up of the 12 tribes that descended from him in the genetic sense of descent. They're literally his offspring. They have his genetic code built in. They come from him through four different women and their gene pool. But nonetheless, these are all the sons of Jacob, and they're a national entity by tribe when they move into the land of Canaan after wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. They become a national entity. They have their own geography. They have their own authority over them. God is their king. And they're led by individuals that God chooses to make his will known to them. And so they become a national entity within this world, a geographical unit. The geographical unit is not the critical issue of a nation. It's the genetic connection. I've said this a lot of times. If you took the 12 tribes of Israel, which constituted the nation of Israel, and moved them to Connecticut, they'd still be a national entity, and they wouldn't have one drop of ground in the old land of Canaan. They'd be a national entity in Connecticut, because the issue is not geography. It's descent, genealogical descent. And that's one of the things I think, and this is just an aside, but it's one of the reasons why I think that a lot of people get confused about where the Antichrist is coming from, because Daniel says the people of the prince that shall come, and the phrase the prince that shall come points to the violent little arrogant horn of the fourth empire. His people are going to destroy the city and the sanctuary. Well, we know who destroyed the city and the sanctuary in our mirror. As we look in the mirror of history, and in AD 70, the city and the sanctuary were destroyed, and they were destroyed by Rome. So, the Antichrist is going to be Roman. But that doesn't mean he's going to come from Italy. It just means that the Antichrist is going to be Roman genetically. But there's a huge block of Americans that are Roman genetically. We came from Europe, and a lot of Europe came from the Roman Empire. So this whole thing is involved in God making nations out of gene pools. So that's the second use, Israel as a nation. Then we have the third use, where there is a small segment of that nation, according to Romans chapter 9, verses 6 through 8, that comes from God's promise to Abraham that he would give him a seed that consists only of the children of promise as distinct from the children of flesh. In Romans 9, he says, not all who are of Israel are Israel, in the sense that there are the children of the flesh, which is all of the genetic developments of children from Jacob down through history. Everybody that had Jacob's gene pool attached to them is a child of the flesh. But in that group of the children of the flesh, there came to be a group called the children of promise. And the children of promise is identified in our previous context of Romans 9 and 10 as, in Isaac shall thy seed come. And that means Isaac was a child of promise, but it means that Isaac's existence depended on sovereign, gracious provision, because God deliberately waited until Abraham and Sarah could not have a child, and then he produced Isaac. But Isaac was genetically Abraham and Sarah. It was just that God's promise was fulfilled by his production. And in our previous study, where God says, I've kept 7,000 of the people, the men, from bowing the knee to Baal, there's this remnant according to the election of grace. So there's this group within the genetic developed nation. There's a group within there that are also not only the children of flesh, but they also have become the children of promise, because God has worked in their situation to cause them to believe his promise and become children of God. And that's what being a child of promise means. It means you've believed the promise and now you're regenerated into the family of God. So we have this third use where you're talking about Israel, but you're talking about a kind of true Israel that are both physical offspring and the remnant that are developed by the election of grace that God creates by his own actions. So that's the first, second, third use. And then the fourth use, Israel indicates the larger segment of the nation that also are just the physical offspring who consistently reject Jacob's and Israel's God, as in Romans 10:21. They're disbelieving and they're argumentative. But he calls this group Israel. So we have an Israel that's known as the hardened, and their destiny is to be judged by the law and consigned by God to eternal death. He is going to judge them according to their identity as the hardened, the ones whose dominion by sin over them has so corrupted them that they are going to suffer the consequences of that dominion of sin over them forever. And then we have one more way that the word Israel is used in a general sense, and that is to identify that part of the house of David that split away from the house of David because of Solomon's son's stupidity. And that's known as the northern kingdom, the kingdom of Israel, and then the southern kingdom was the kingdom of Judah. So then there became Judah and Israel. And people use the word Israel. Oftentimes we're talking about the northern kingdom. And that's where Elijah was. He was in the northern kingdom. So you have these uses of Israel that fluctuate. It depends on the text and the context, which ones he's talking about. And that's the whole point here, is that we have multiple ways that the word Israel is used, multiple individual or groups that are identified by that term, Israel. it's really kind of interesting that in the fragmentation of the house of David, you ended up with two fragments. The northern kingdom, which the kings would never let any of those people come down to worship in Jerusalem. So the vast majority of them, excluding the 7,000 that God preserved as an election of grace, the vast majority of them were the hardened. And in Judah, you had a bunch of hardened people too, but by and large, the Judah was more faithful, if you can say it that way. There were more people believing God in the history of Judah up to the Babylonian captivity and afterward. But you had these fragments, the children of the promise, the children of the flesh, and there's a group in both nations or kingdoms. Judah has its children of the flesh and children of promise, and Israel has more children of the flesh and fewer children of promise, but it's a mixed thing. So in our current text, what we have to understand is that Paul's use of Israel in the question of whether Israel's behavior has resulted in a fall into eternal rejection by God is not a question of whether he's reacting to the hardened, because he is going to consign them to an eternal fall. They did in the crucifixion of the Son as the hardened. They are going to be brought to condemnation. And Jesus said, you're going to die in your sins if you don't believe that I am he. So he's not using Israel when he says no. He's not using Israel in the sense there of specific individuals that because they did this heinous thing that they're suddenly going to be consigned to hell forever. Because Saul was among those who did that heinous thing. He was tickled to death when Jesus was crucified. And afterwards he held the garments of those who stoned Stephen as the first martyr. When Stephen told them that they had murdered their own Messiah. He was glad to do that. And he was glad to go persecuting them and chasing them all over everywhere. Until God decided, you know, it's time. It's time that this person that I've decided is going to be my servant, take the gospel to Gentiles. It's time I made myself known to him. And so he did on the road to Damascus. The whole point here is that I think that the issue of the Israel that God is not going to allow to fall, that their transgression has caused salvation to go to the Gentiles. It's going to be riches for the world and riches for the nations and their fulfillment. That Israel, I believe, is national Israel. What he's saying is Israel as a nation is not going to be dispersed or declared nullified because this people is hard-hearted. Because they're not all. Always in Israel there was this remnant. Isaiah said, though the children of Israel are as the sand of the sea, it is the remnant that shall be delivered. So you have this remnant theology that runs through. But the fact is there's always a believing group within the nation, and God can't destroy the nation without destroying the promises to those that trusted him, and the ones that trust him believe the promise that he was going to make of Abraham a great nation. So you got this nation thing that's got to come to pass. And so this whole issue then is whether is how God is using or Paul is using this term Israel, and I believe it has to do with the promise that had the beginning with Abraham, where he said, I'm going to make of you a great nation. And then he developed through Isaac and then Jacob, and through Jacob, the 12 tribes. He developed through this man that he renamed Israel. He developed this nation, Israel, as a nation, the national Israel. For all of Israel's history, there's been this mixed grouping. And according to the eschatology of the scriptures, it's going to stay mixed until the time of great tribulation, where in a very real sense, the winnower is winnowing the chaff from the wheat, and he's going to gather the wheat in his barn, burn up the chaff. And that, I believe, is historically and prophetically developed at the time that Michael stands up and there's great tribulation such as has never been before. Israel is going to be purged as a nation so that finally, there will come a time at the end of the tribulation period where all Israel will be saved. That means everybody who's still alive, who is a genetic descendant of Jacob, are also going to be believers in Jesus the Messiah. And at that point, there's going to be a kingdom set up, and Jesus is going to be ruling the kingdom of David, which is the nation of Israel. So that's the scenario. So the conclusion here is that Paul's declaration that God did not reject his people and that the transgression of Israel did not lead to God's condemnation of Israel is rooted in the original promise of a nation. He's talking about national Israel. Now, there are individuals that make it up, and we've already been identified to the two groups within that, because in verse 7 of this chapter, it says, that which Israel is seeking for, it has not obtained, but those who were chosen obtained it, and the rest were hardened. The whole idea there is this group called Israel, but within it there is the hardened, and then there is this remnant according to grace. So, that brings us to verse 12, and this unanticipated reaction by God that's raised in verse 11. And I want to reiterate that there was a reason for the lack of anticipation, that the answer was going to be no. Am I saying that God's fed up with this Israel? He's going to be done with it. This is just absolutely pathetic what they've done. He's just going to destroy them as a national entity and have nothing to do with them from then on. And keep this in mind. The nation was dispersed in AD 70. And as far as the world was concerned, the nation had been disbanded and turned loose. God didn't have anything for them. And that lasted until 1948. Almost 1900 years later, Israel was re-established in the land by the decree of the nations, but it was because of the persecution that had occurred in Hitler's Germany, where he tried to eradicate everybody who had any of the genetic linkage to Jacob or Israel. He wanted to get rid of all the Jews. And because of the 6 million Jews that Hitler murdered, and in the way that he did it, there was this universal worldwide reaction of probably guilt as well as revulsion. And so they decided that they would give these offspring of Israel a place of their own. And so they reestablished them in the land. And the nation was reborn in that day. And it's never happened in the history of the world that a nation that passed off the scene came back onto the scene and was reestablished as a nation. But it did with Israel, because God's not through with this promise to Abraham. Made a promise. So, when Paul raises the question, am I saying that God's reaction was going to be judicial? That he was going to give them what they had coming? And he said, no. Actually, God's going to give the Gentiles what Israel thought they had coming. The question in verse 12 is, if their transgression is riches for the world and their failure be riches for the Gentiles, then how much more will their fulfillment be? I mean, if you think salvation of the Gentiles and to the world was a good thing, and it is, how much better do you think it's going to be when Israel actually comes into the fulfillment of the promise? But it was an unanticipated reaction on God's part. Most of the Roman believers were going to say, yeah, there's a limit to the long-suffering of God. How long is long? Well, this long. And he's going to just destroy them and have nothing more to do with them. And that made a lot of sense after AD 70 for a long, long time. And that's where the nonsense came into play, when the so-called church, and I call it that on purpose because a lot of what was called the church after the first century was not the church at all. It was a visible thing, but it wasn't God's church. But nonetheless, the visible church began to say, we are spiritual Israel. We're the fulfillment of God's promises to Abraham for this nation. We're the nation. And that's just not true. But even our last most effective conservative president, Ronald Reagan, said that we were a city upon a hill. That's Old Testament terminology for Israel being the light to the world. Well, we're not. But that comes out of Reformation theology. Nonetheless, one of the reasons, the main reason that this attitude that God owes them disaster for their behavior was because first century Judaism saw God as primarily, and as it turns out theologically, exclusively just. God is God of justice. To the Jew and to a lot of Reformed theology people, holy, holy, holy means righteous, 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 or just, just, just. Their fixation on the justice of God is, it's amazing, Because whether they recognize it or not, and I don't think they do, the exaltation of God as a God of justice above all else inserts the necessity of the breakdown of the integrity of the glory of God. They don't even realize that. If you're going to insist that God is just, then God's got to destroy all the wicked. He can't have people like Saul of Tarsus being converted to Christianity and being saved out of their sin. He's got to hammer them. They've done some wicked things. But when you say they, all of a sudden you're including yourself in that. There's a whole lot of this kind of nonsense that goes around and says, why does God allow evil if he's a God of love? Well, where do you want to push that? How much evil have you done? I mean, if the greatest commandment is to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength every day that you live, that you don't do that, you are sinning. And how is a God of love going to tolerate that? So, you know, as soon as the person realizes that if there was not a permission on God's part for less than perfect behavior, we'd all be sunk. So this holy, holy, holy means dead, dead, dead to everybody that's ever sinned. And I think that they just don't even see that. That the focus on justice demands a lack of integrity on God's part, because integrity has its roots in doing what was promised, and justice has its roots in the retribution that's visited upon what's done. Well, if the focus is on retribution and what's done, that's the justice of God. But if everybody gets what they got coming, there ain't going to be any kingdom. There ain't going to be any people. And therefore, the promise of God to Abraham goes flying way out into infinity. It's not there anymore. God just broke his word. He made a promise he didn't keep. And it's all because he's just. Well, we recognize that that's not possible. When what is promised is denied by what is done, integrity dissolves. When promise is denied by what is done, because retribution is visited upon what's done, then integrity is gone. It dissolves into nothing. I think the lack of sight regarding God's grace as a issue involved in this whole thing, the grace automatically resulted in a total lack of anticipation in respect to God's reaction to the national sin of Israel. When Israel crucifies their Messiah and everybody says, well, then God would be right to just smash them to smithereens. What they did was heinous beyond even description. And they got no complaint if he just demolishes them. And all that comes right out of a legal mindset. Where is grace in that? There isn't any grace in that. It's all what you got coming. So it was grace that caused the answer, no, he's not going to do that. But it's an unanticipated answer because they're not fixated on grace yet. They don't have their focus right. So what does he actually say in relation to verse 12 in terms of the grace impact? He said in verse 11 that the grace impact would be that salvation would come to the Gentiles. Their transgression was going to cause God to visit salvation on the Gentiles to make those transgressors so jealous that they would actually repent and turn back to God. That's grace. And that's the grace impact. So in verse 12 he says, now, if their transgression is riches for the world, and their failure be riches for the Gentiles. Now there he's talking about that grace impact. Transgression, which should have meant destruction for the nation, instead of meaning that, meant riches for the world. And their failure, which should have resulted in their condemnation, meant riches for the nations. Now let's think about that, because this is a twofold divine, unanticipated, grace-based reaction by God. And it had two parts because the action of Israel had two parts. Israel is faulted by God in verse 12 in terms of the word transgression. This is New American Standard Translation. In terms of transgression and failure. Their transgression is riches for the world. Their failure is riches for the nation. So there's a twofold fault thing here. And the word that's translated transgression is the right translation because it means to step across the boundary. A transgression was what occurred in Genesis 3. Don't eat. I'm going to eat. So they did. They stepped across a known boundary. They transgressed. And when you compare what Adam did by eating a forbidden fruit in the garden to what national Israel did to Jesus as their Christ at Calvary, there's no comparison. This is disobedience, but this is vile, vehement, murderous behavior. Which is worse? Well, I would say the death of Christ was the worst, but look what the disobedience of Adam brought. You want a comparison of bad news? It's bad news that Adam did. Brought on all the stuff that's in the world, including the crucifixion of the Christ, but that's just the end game. That was just the way it worked up until the climax of their rebellion. And Paul is using that kind of analogy by saying, look, if this transgression, which is this thing, crucifying the Christ, what did it bring? Well, it brought riches to the world. So the first issue is transgression, and it's the idea of deliberately, willfully doing a terrible thing, and that is the crucifixion of their own Christ. But also he's faulted by the word failure. That word is rare. It's only used twice in the whole New Testament, and both times by Paul, once here and once in 1 Corinthians 6:7. But when I looked in the English lexicon of the New Testament based on semantic domains, that's actually the title of the work. It's not quite longer than the book is thick, but nonetheless, it's a very scholarly, highly detailed dictionary based on language issues. And their definition for this word is a lack of attaining a desirable state or condition. In other words, Israel's lack of attainment of their desired condition is going to result in riches for the Gentiles. Now, what is Paul already said in this chapter, in this section? What was Israel seeking to attain? A righteous standing before God based on performance of his commands. Righteousness based on law. That was their goal. How close did they come to achieving it? Not within a million miles. Paul said, there is no flesh justified by the works of the law. So Israel was seeking for this status before God based on their performance so that they could maintain their pride and still be accepted by God in a kingdom of humility. I mean, you work that one out. And God said, no, you're not coming into my kingdom with that kind of an attitude, period. If you try to approach my kingdom on the basis of your performance, you're going to get what your performance requires of you. You're not going to get my kingdom. So they didn't achieve it. That's what they wanted. They failed to achieve it. Well, what did that failure result in? Riches for the nations. And I'm deliberately changing the word Gentiles to nations because it's the same word. It's just translated two different ways. But the issue here is, I believe, national Israel, the world, and the nations of the non-Jews, the Gentile nations. So, because Paul says in Romans 9 that Israel sought after a righteousness based on law and didn't attain it, and then he asks the question immediately after saying that in chapter 9, what shall we say then? And the issue of their failure to attain and what shall we conclude from that is exactly the same things going on here. What shall we conclude? That their lack of attaining what they were going after is going to actually result in riches for the nations, the Gentile nations. So Paul is in a very real sense circling here. He started this in chapter 9, verse 29, and now he's restating it. Well, even in verses 5 through 7 of this chapter. In the same way, then, there came about at present time a remnant according to God's gracious choice. But if it's by grace, it's no longer on the basis of the works. Otherwise, grace is no longer grace. What shall we say, then? That which Israel is seeking for, it has not obtained. But those who were chosen obtained it. So he's saying in verse 12, their lack of attainment of this thing that they're seeking for, which he identified as a standing before God based on their performance, is going to be riches for the nations. So that was the twofold impact. They murdered their Messiah. That was the transgression. And their pursuit of a legal standing before God was a total disaster. They did not achieve it. So what did God do? Well, on the transgression side, he said this was going to result in riches for the world. And on the failure side, it's going to be riches for the nations, because the nations weren't looking for it, and they got it. Israel was pursuing it, and they didn't get it. So that's his argument. But let's think about this reaction. In the umbrella form, Paul narrows it down to the issue of verse 11. Salvation has come to the Gentiles. Salvation. It's a big umbrella. It's a huge thing. Salvation includes all kinds of enormously significant concepts, like the forgiveness of all your sins, the promise of eternal life, all of the scenario of the future, which includes glorified bodies that are everything God ever intended for a body to be for a human being once he's in his glorified state. Souls that are united to Christ in a kind of love that just is over the top in terms of loyalty. There's, you love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. It's just, that's automatic. And your task in his kingdom, which is your spiritual identity in the kingdom, what your job is and all that, is assigned to you. And so everything that you can imagine involving this enormous picture of blessing is called salvation. That's the umbrella. But under that umbrella, he expands the concept of salvation into two things, and he calls it, in both places, riches. Well, that word riches is used a lot in the New Testament, but in Romans, I think it's used four, maybe five times. But the point is that in Romans, the word riches invariably means a kind of vastness that exists in the measure of God's gracious goodness. In other words, riches is God's goodness without measure. There's this vastness in here. That's why it's called riches. It's kind of like Scrooge and his whole, castle full of gold coins that he goes to count. And he's just got this enormous wealth in terms of gold coins. And there's so many of them that he couldn't count them all if he wanted to. Well, that's our concept of riches. It's this vast amount of huge benefit, except that it's not money, because money is a false god. It's the benefit of God's willingness to be gracious and merciful and kind and good without measure. It's vast riches. That's the way the word is used. And he actually uses it twice in verse 12. Riches for the world, riches for the nations. But in dividing it that way, so that their riches are for the world and there are riches for the nations, because the world and the nations are sort of, synonymous, sort of. I don't believe in true synonyms. So. But in both cases, the riches are what God grants as a vast measure of his provision of life. The promise is life. The joy is the joy of life. The promise is therefore joy of life. And it's a vast promise, joy inexpressible and full of glory. And in the first phrase, the focus is on this riches as it's poured out onto the world. And in this context, I believe that the world is most likely that geographical domain that has been prophesied to become Christ's kingdom. The kingdoms of this world have become the kingdom of our Lord, or of God and His Christ. That's the idea of the world as a geographical identification of national. It takes something more than the unity of genetic connection to make a nation. The nation is not geographical, but you can't function as a nation without some territory. So whether you move them from Israel to Connecticut, whatever, you got to put them somewhere, and that's the geographical thing. Well, in this context, this idea of riches for the world, it means the entire globe of the world, all of the domains that are divided up among the kingdoms of this world are all geographical identities, and this is going to be riches for all of them. Every place on the planet, once the fulfillment of the Jews comes, because that's the question, what will it be like when their fulfillment comes? Well, Israel is going to be the top nation over the nations over which Jesus is both Lord and Christ. Israel as the head of the nations. Israel doesn't realize this, but that really means being the servant, chief serving nation. It's that old idea that in the Gentile way of thinking, the greatest is the one who calls the shots and everybody serves them. But in the kingdom of Messiah, it's the people who get to serve, who do the serving, that are greatest in the kingdom. So Israel's going to be the greatest kingdom, the greatest nation in the kingdoms, or the greatest kingdoms of the kingdoms of the world. But it will be out of the richness of Israel's connection with the Christ that all of these other nations are going to prosper. So all of the geographical realm of the world is included in this wealth, this vastness of wealth. And then he turns it deliberately to the issue of the nations themselves. In both cases, the riches are what God grants, this vast measure of life. But in the second phrase, focus on riches are poured out onto the nations. And again, in this context, I believe the nations are most likely a reference to those national entities that have been granted by prophecy an extension of life into Christ's kingdom. Because Matthew 25, verses 32 and following say there's going to come a time when the Christ is going to call the kingdoms of, or the nations of the world to judgment, and he's going to divide them into sheep nations and goat nations. And the thing that's going to divide is the way they treated Israel while they were in their national entities or identities, while Israel was in its national identity. So the ones that curse the nation of Israel and try to destroy it and push it into the sea and obliterate it and all, those are goat nations. And God is going to consign them to eternal destruction. And the sheep nations are the ones who were pro-Israel, and they were supportive of Israel's identity as a nation, and they tried to help Israel. He talks about it in terms of, when I was in prison, you fed me, and when I needed water, you gave me water. And they said, when do we do that? And as much as you did to the least of these, my brother, and you did it to me, and that kind of thing. The whole point there is, there's coming a time when Messiah's going to set up a kingdom. It's called the fulfillment of Israel. That's what Israel's been looking for forever, the reign of Messiah. But before he actually begins to reign, he's actually going to establish individual national identities over his entire world. All of them will be serving him in their national structures and identities. And Israel will be the top kingdom over all of that. And of course, the church is going to be over Israel. So, you know, we're going to be the sanctified bureaucrats that are going to influence the rule of all the nations in the world, ruling and reigning with Christ. So, I really believe that what Paul is dealing with here is that in the pouring out of the wealth on the nations, he's shifting from the geographical domain to the individual segments of that geography that are taken up by individual nations that are being blessed by God for the way they treated Israel. And there are going to be nations like Egypt, for example, that are going to be there. There's some prophecies concerning Egypt in Messiah's kingdom. There'll be other nations, like some we have on the planet today, especially the Islamic ones that want to destroy Israel. They're goat nations, and they're going to be treated like that. But the whole point here is that there is this huge contrast in these two verses about what was anticipated and what was not anticipated. And Paul says what was not anticipated is what's going to be. There's going to be this grace impact based on all of the stuff that Israel failed in. God is going to turn all of that failure into wealth for the entire world and every nation in it when the Jews are finally brought to that perfect balance where all of the physical seed of Israel are also children of promise because they believed in Jesus as their Christ. And they go into this kingdom setting. And it's going to be an enormously, a vastly rich kind of experience for everybody that's there. And it's because God has turned this He's turned this pride of status, where I want to be accepted by God on the basis of my performance, and he's turned this murderous rage into tools of benefit for the whole world and all the nations that are going to be in it. That's the unanticipated reaction of God.